And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you. Joseph Cooper still recovering from his back injury. We wish him well and hope he is back soon. In 2011, Akashic Books published Haiti Noir, a collection of stories edited by Miami-based novelist Edwige Dantica. Each installment of Akashic's acclaimed noir series is set in a different part of the world. The stories are dark in nature. They deal with crime, corruption, and other human frailties. Haiti Noir came out a year after the earthquake that devastated Port-au-Prince. It was so successful that Akashic asked Dantica to edit a sequel. Now, in Haiti Noir 2, she reaches into the past for stories by classic Haitian writers who used mystery and suspense to give their readers a clear-eyed view of their ill-starred nation. Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez spoke with Dantica. He began by asking her what popular genres like mystery and suspense can tell us about a country like Haiti.
It can probably tell us many things, both sort of the unusual, the eccentricity of a place like that, and the darkness, certainly. But in this book, we try to cover a whole range of noir. We try to redefine the genre. And the fact that, for example, this series in the noir series, is Haiti Noir 2, and there are stories that were already written. So we're pulling from Haitian literature from 1910 to the present, but things that have already existed. So we get to define for ourselves what noir is. For example, you have a story by Jacques-Stéphane Alexis, who's one of our seminal writers, and it's set during the U.S. occupation. It's about a colonel who comes, you know, and he's assigned this little village. And the first mistakes he makes is that the villagers come to welcome him with some presents, and he pays them for it. And then everything turns dark because his payment to them is seen as this huge insult. And then things start twisting in this funny, unusual way. And there's also a story by Danny Laferrière about sex tourism, and that has a mystery element to it. So it's, I think, you know, you read noir the way you would read Miami noir in any other place to sort of see the underbelly of a place. But I think, incidentally, we can also see the soul of a place.
Well, this is part of Akashic Books' noir series, as you alluded to. And this series has been going on for about 10 years now. And it's been covering pretty much the whole globe. Mm-hmm. But I think this is the first time they've had a sequel. I don't think they've ever had, they've revisited a place.
Actually, they have.
They have?
Yeah,
okay,
they have. It's starting to be sort of, the world is noired by Akashic Books and then re-noired, I guess, in part two of the series. So they have New Orleans Noir 2, Chicago Noir 2, and Brooklyn Noir 2, D.C. Noir 2, Manhattan Noir 2. So we might be, you know, San Francisco Noir 2, we might be maybe the first Noir 2 country, maybe, but
outside the U.S.
Outside the U.S. But the series have had such a success, I think, because it allows, just what you're saying, it allows people the opportunity to see a place differently. For example, before I started editing the series, I read Paris Noir, and I had, you know, as a college student, spent my junior year in Paris, and I had been to Paris many times, but when I read Paris Noir, it gave me this whole other view of the city, you know, beyond sort of the tourism glamour. So I think that the series can do that to a city where you feel like you're getting an inside glimpse by people who are from the place, people who live or have lived in that place.
Our guest today is best-selling novelist and short story writer Edwige Dantica, who's here to discuss Haiti Noir 2, an anthology of stories about Haiti that she edited. The subtitle is The Classics. How does it differ from the first anthology 3 years ago?
Well, the first anthology, Haiti Noir, they were all new stories. So they were stories that were actually commissioned for the volume, and we had about 18 of those from writers who were living in Haiti, living in Canada, in France. One was living in Rome at the time. Just Haitian writers or writers of Haitian descent, and also some American writers who had written about Haiti. But all the stories were new and were written for that article. Some had been written in English, others in Creole, others in French. Those were translated. This series, the classic series in the Akashic Noir series, or previously published stories that then you call from. So, of course, these writers in Haiti Noir 2, most of them are no longer with us. And many of them are seminal writers in the Haitian canon, like Jacques Roumain, Jacques-Stéphane Alexis, Ida Faubert, who was one of the first women writers to be published in Haiti, Paulette Pujol-Oyol, who passed away not too long ago. Among them are some younger writers, some contemporary writers who have written poems or stories that I think ultimately one day will be considered classics. And it was interesting to me to put them in conversation with these older writers. Sometimes the themes echoed one another. It was incredible to see writers today sometimes writing about things that a writer was writing about in 1910. So it's a very, I see the book as kind of an interesting conversation, and the noir is sort of the table around which all of these writers sit.
Well, there were some classic tales that I was surprised not to find in the anthology, like Truman Capote's House of Flowers.
We tried to get that.
Yeah, an excerpt from, of course, The Comedians by mm-hmm. Graham Greene. That's one of the, you know, great works of about the Duvalier's Haiti. Mm-hmm. Was that because was that a business decision? You just couldn't afford the rights for those stories?
Well, first of all, we did want to prioritize Haitian writers because there's such a, everybody knows these stories, The Comedians and these other stories. We wanted to prioritize Haitian writers. And there are a lot of Haitian writers, too, that I wish I could have gotten. For example, I feel like if there are classic noir writers, there are these two brothers, Philippe and Toby Marcelin, who wrote books that were actually translated in the United States in the 1940s and had their books had a preface by Edmund Wilson, who was writing for The New Yorker at that time, who was a great admirer.
Who did write, I think, an interesting book, a nonfiction book about Haiti, didn't
he? Yes. And he was really a big supporter of these brothers. And they wrote these books, one of them, The Beast of the Haitian Hills, All Men Are Mad, a book named Canapé Vert. And they wrote, for example, about the Catholic Church's anti-superstition campaign against voodoo. And they wrote like these stories set in the villages with noir elements. Like if you think of noir writers, immediately people who write directly noir in the contemporary, I would think of a writer named Guy Victor, who is in our first volume, and then the Marcelin brothers. So them and other writers I wish we couldn't have gotten, but we were restrained by space, also by funds, and sometimes by the inability to find heirs. But I see the book, I encourage people to see it as a sampling, something to give you a little taste, and then encourage you to go out and read more Haitian literature.
We're speaking with novelist Edwige Dandicott, who has edited an anthology of stories about Haiti called Haiti Noir 2. Let's look at some of the stories in the anthology. Jacques Roman, I'm going to mispronounce every name, I'm sure. Preface to the Life of a Bureaucrat. This is perhaps, this was the earliest written story in the anthology in the 1920s or 30s. Mm-hmm. And Roman was a friend of Langston Hughes, the African-American poet who talked about dreams drying up like a raisin in the sun. And I saw this in the story that is about a dream drying up, isn't it? Tell us about that one.
Yeah, that story, was published in 1930 and was written by Jacques Roumain. And Jacques Roumain is considered one of Haiti's seminal writers. And his novel, Gouverneur de la Housée, Masters of the Dew, was translated by Langston Hughes and Mercer Cook. They were great pals. And Langston Hughes had traveled to Haiti quite a bit, and when Jacques Roumain came to the United States, he actually, because of his friendship with Langston Hughes, wrote a lot about the African American experience, about lynching, about discrimination, and other things. His story, Preface to the Life of a Bureaucrat, is one of those stories in the book that's translated for the very first time in English. And he was a novelist as well as a short story writer. And the story is about this man who has been living in Europe in a kind of exile. And then he returns to Haiti and he's very happy to be back. You know, he says something like, you know, he wants to hug everybody he sees on the street and says, hello, brother, hello, sister. And then he has this mother-in-law who's of, you know, who's Haitian of German heritage, who he hates, and she makes references to sort of when she talks about herself, she talks about sort of white ladies like ourselves, and he's sort of this novelist, which was one of the things that drew me to the story. He's a frustrated novelist who's trying to write, and all his in-laws, they're pressuring him to get a job as a bureaucrat, you know, to get an office job. And the story is one of the twists on the noir. It sort of talks about sort of this internal death, you know, and one of them is succumbing to sort of being this, you know, this frustrated novelist who can't practice his craft, who first has to submit to this mother-in-law that he literally, sometimes you think he's going to kill. And then, but he has to face this other level of death too, and the fact that whether he will kill himself physically or kill himself psychologically by becoming a bureaucrat.
But the story also talks about the class differences in Haiti, with the bourgeoisie and the elites and the poor, and that sometimes that's connected to racial classification. So that hasn't changed much, has it?
Well, it's really, when you read, that's one of the things that interested me, and contrasting some of the stories of the today and these older classics, and that, yes, he was, as also in Jacquemin's other work, you see that, because Masters of the Dew, the book that was translated by Links and News, was also had those differences, you know, the class differences, poverty, all the things that he deals with here.
We need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with Edwige Dandicott. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is best-selling novelist and short story writer Edwige Dandicott. In 2011, Ms. Dandicott edited an anthology of darkly toned stories set in her native land. It was called Haiti Noir. It was so well-received that her publisher asked her to edit a sequel, Haiti Noir 2, which she's here to discuss. Voodoo. Voodoo, unfortunately, is a stereotype with Haitians. When people think of Haiti, they think of voodoo. There are two stories here that attracted my attention that deal with voodoo. A Strange Story by Ida Forbair. Mm-hmm. Another is Oresca by Paulette Pujol-Oriol. I'm probably mispronouncing that. I found them interesting because they're not about voodoo necessarily as a supernatural thing, but as a tool of oppression, something to instill fear in the public. Is that what one can look at voodoo as sometimes? It's just something that is manipulated to have an effect on the public?
Well, I think, you know, these writers also, the Ida Forbair and Paulette, were writing in a much earlier time. And they were also, I mean, they were trying and to show these all these different ways that people perceive and use voodoo. And so the point of their stories, for example, you know, even during the dictatorship where you had
Duvalier,
the right. Duvalier dictatorship, and right. and Duvalier dressed as Baron Samedi, who's the sort of the master of the cemetery, and these other ways that often people will misuse a religion to oppress others, and I think that was that was primarily the point of these stories, the misuse of religion, just as people can misuse Catholicism, they can misuse all other types of religions. Was the point of these stories?
Mm-hmm. Well, another story that had a kind of supernatural element to it was by Jean-Jay Dominique, a White House, long title, A White House with Pink Curtains in the Downstairs Windows. And this is, a very interesting psychological tale I gather to be an unreliable narrator.
Mm-hmm.
It reminded me of some American stories like The Yellow Wallpaper by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, which is a classic.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's written by a man.
No, it's a woman.
Oh, it's a woman. So it's a woman.
Jean Dominique was, she still is a novelist and short story writer. She was a very well-known radio personality in Haiti. Her father was Jean Dominique, who was a very...
I'm confusing her with her father.
Yeah, actually, yes. It's an interesting confusion because her first novel, Mémoire d'une amnésiaque, Memoirs of an Amnesiac, was actually dealt with that issue. And the main character has a name like hers that can be mistaken for a man's name and sort of has, who has her father's name and it plays on her own reality. But she is indeed a woman. And that story is a fascinating story because it's one of several stories where it seems like you actually have a procedural happening where there's a police person there and someone is giving a confession, because it's very hard as even in the case of Jean Dominique has proven, it's very hard to get justice the traditional way where, a Sherlock Holmes-like character shows up and solves this mystery. So a lot of our stories are not resolved that way. And one of the ways that some are resolved is through a kind of confessional. And in her story, the very unreliable narrator attempts to say what happens, and we're not sure whether to believe her. And we don't really actually find out in the end what it might actually be. So I think that's it's a very deftly written story that I think borrows from many traditions of the noir, certainly from the confession, kind of testimonial and all these different things happening, but you're never sure what to believe. Mm-hmm. And again, she, the writer as well as the narrator also misdirects her attention towards the supernatural. But it's in another way, a story that's also features mental illness possibly and hallucinations,
yeah, sure,
and all of these things that make someone's narrative very unreliable, and it makes it also a mystery to the reader because then you have to figure out what is actually happening.
That's what I love about the device of the unreliable narrator. It teaches the reader. In other words, the reader has to learn how to read more carefully than perhaps he's used to, because you just take what you read for granted sometimes. The authorial voice you accept what they say. But then when someone who's unreliable, who's getting things wrong or perhaps trying to deceive you, then you have to really look between the lines more carefully.
Absolutely. I think you have to be a much more careful reader. Like you said, you have to really pay so much more attention when you have that kind of narrator.
Mm. We're speaking with Edwige Dandicott about her anthology of stories set in Haiti called Haiti Noir 2. There's one story written by a non-Haitian, Ben Fountain, an American writer, mm-hmm, very good American writer. And I don't know if I'm getting pronounced that title right.
Rêve Haïtien, which means Haitian dream.
That means Haitian dream. Mm-hmm. Rêve Haïtien. And it's told from the point of view, not of a Haitian, but of a foreigner.
Of like an observer.
An OAS, the Organization of American States Observer, mm-hmm, right after Aristide is overthrown, mm-hmm, when there's a military coup.
And in the 1990s, after, yeah.
Yeah, and you have widespread violence in Port-au-Prince. As he says, it seems like his job is more just counting bodies than it is observing. But he's approached, the hero is approached by a Haitian man who asks him to smuggle in paintings to the U.S., to Miami, in order to sell them for a reduced price in return, so that he could use the money to buy guns. And it's interesting because people forget that Haiti has such a rich tradition of art. It has great art behind it. And yet here, you know, the story is about selling that cultural legacy just for guns, just so you can commit violence with it. What attracted you to that story?
Well, one of the things that attracted me to that story was that element of art. And the narrator, as well as the writer, were very knowledgeable on art. And the artists they mentioned were actually real artists. The other was this element of struggle. Sort of the person who was trying to sell this art to buy the guns was, if people remember that time, and I remember that time, it was a very repressive time. You had this junta in power, and people were being killed like by the hundreds per day. And it shows, I think that story too, in a way, as a lot of the stories are kind of historical markers. So you have the Jacques Stéphane Alexis stories, which talks about a period during the U.S. occupation, which starts in 1915. And then you have this story towards the end, which also depicts this period. And also the foreigners' roles. I think even it's very hard to ignore foreigners' roles in Haiti and the sort of these positions that they tend to play. And this character was, in a way, emblematic of that, and but still somewhat sympathetic, trying to do the right thing. And but there was also this mystery element, because you're never sure what exactly he was going to do. So that to me was very interesting. But it's also, you know, none of these stories were written originally as noir. So it's someone has to read, in a way, when they come together. I think that element of the book's theme is amplified by their even being placed together.
As editor, you have the prerogative of putting in one of your own stories, and you did. It's the Port-au-Prince marriage special. And it's a sad story, really, about a maid at a hotel who contracts AIDS from a tourist. And what is the Port-au-Prince marriage special? Is that really a term that's known in Haiti? You didn't invent it. That's something that...
No, I invented it.
Oh, you did.
I invented it. And but the also in my story, one of the things I wanted to explore is that it's the same issue, for example, with the issue of cholera in Haiti, right? So you have, you know, this the UN, this contingent of the UN comes and they start this plague, they start cholera, people die, hundreds and thousands of people get sick, and then there's no, you know, you're still blamed for it. And so before that there was the AIDS and how it became our stigma, but then there were these stories underneath, and people would all say, oh, you know, AIDS destroyed tourism. So when I wrote that story long ago as a story that sort of talks about both AIDS and tourism, and it's one of those things where a lot of the stories do that, in a way. They revisit a kind of cliche or kind of stigma or kind of taboo differently, from a different perspective. And that's what I was trying to also do in that story, to tell also the story of people getting fake medicine, which the character gets, and all of the behind the scenes of things that people think they know, and then you can revisit them differently through this another character.
Thank you for coming in. We've been speaking with Edwige Dandicott.
And Ariel Gonzalez is an English professor at Miami-Dade College. You can see his reviews and blog on the Huffington Post. He also reviews books for the Miami Herald and, of course, interviews authors for Topical Currents. Food and Dining is up next. And we're back with today's Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman, and joining you, I'm sure, in our hopes for Joseph Cooper's speedy return from a severe back injury. Well, 1 week from today, the 2014 FIFA World Cup kicks off at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, with Brazil playing Croatia in Sao Paulo, Brazil. What does that have to do with food and dining? Well, we'll find out. Joining us now is Cordon Bleu chef, author and syndicated columnist and friend,
Why do you laugh every time you say that, Bonnie?
Because you're always waiting for me to say it. Linda Gassenheimer. Welcome, Linda. What are we serving up today?
What are we serving up? World Cup, as you said. It starts next week. So I've been thinking about Brazilian food. What else would I think about?
Of course.
So what are the flavors or what are the popular dishes there? Anna French has some answers for us. She's the author of a Brazilian cookbook, and it's called A Pinch, a Dash, and a Pocketful of Cash. Well, welcome, Anna French.
Good afternoon, Linda. Good afternoon to all, and thank you so much for having me on your show today.
Oh, it's our pleasure. She filled the studio with food. What could be worse?
Or better.
Okay, and we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. What is your favorite Brazilian dish, or do you have some questions for Anna French? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. And I think we do have email, Bonnie?
We do. It's radio at WLRN.org.
Okay, also with us is our favorite wine guy. It's Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype. He gives the wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes column that you can read in today's Miami Herald. You can also read Fred's wine column in today's Herald. And Fred, what are we drinking today?
Well, what do you need with big chunks of steak served on a sword? You need big red wine to go with it. And the best choice would be wine from Brazil.
Well, Anna is giving you a thumbs up, Fred.
Good. Glad to see it. Well, okay. Hear it.
Or hear it anyway. Anna French, Brazilian cuisine. Now, it seems to me that, you know, Brazil is such a melting pot. So many different cultures live there, different customs. So tell me, what are some of the typical Brazilian flavors?
Well, I say that Brazil is a melting pot of a huge diversity of several types, a variety of backgrounds. You have German, you have Portuguese, you have Indonesian, you have African.
And all of these flavors come together
in
the various dishes.
It comes together in a perfect combination in the kitchen.
Well, I will say it's perfect because we're eating it right now. But before we get to that, I love your title, A Pinch, a Dash, and a Pocketful of Cash.
Yeah, what about that cash?
Explain that to us.
Well, I decided to come up with this cookbook based on Brazilian recipes, some of which are my own creations, and to make it budget conscious so everybody can enjoy a rich Brazilian meal.
So these are Brazilian dishes with their pocketbook in mind.
Exactly.
Okay. Oh. So, well, you know, when you go to Brazilian restaurants here in Miami anyway, many of them are just all meat, you know, meat on a sword, we've been saying.
Yes, we call that in Brazil rodízio.
Rodízio,
right. Or churrasco.
Okay.
In Brazil, we call those type of restaurants churrascarias.
And is that typical of most of the restaurants there?
Yes.
So explain what it is, because some people may not have been.
It's a world wild of all different types of meat, from chicken, from lamb, to every single part of the pork, beef, and sausage, and all that yummy stuff.
And then they come around to the table, and they'll keep coming and coming
they'll
and
coming.
They'll
keep coming until you put that red sign that says no.
That's my favorite part about it. You could consume 5,000 calories in a couple of hours at one of those.
That is true. That is true. And my strong advice is go there very hungry. Don't go there on a full stomach.
I have a question for Anna, because we were talking before and she said she's never taken a culinary course. She's never used to, at least, read a cookbook. And is your mom listening right now?
No, she's not. I hope not.
Okay. And that your mom was not the best cook. So where did you get this?
Like I told you, at the age of 8, I baked my first cake, and from there I just kept on and kept on and kept on. I never stopped.
And so how did you decide to write a cookbook? Because that's not sort of your profession.
No, it's not. It's something that it's been in the back burner for many years. I just never really came around to doing it. And I took advantage that I was unemployed for 1 year, and I decided to take that negative time of being unemployed, if you want to say, and turn it into something positive. While looking for work, I decided to write.
Well, we're the benefits of the positive thinking. Now, so that's, we've been talking about this food here in the studio. So tell me, there's a shrimp dish. So tell us what this is.
That is a very typical dish from Brazil. It's called bobó de camarão, which camarão in Portuguese means shrimp.
So it's, that means rice and shrimp, or what does that mean?
No, bobó is just the name that we call it.
Okay.
It's a mixture of juca with shrimp.
Well, and it's got an orange or red sauce on that. So what's in it?
It's tomato sauce with juca, coconut milk, parsley, green scallions, green peppers, onions, basil leaves. It's just a rich combination and lemon juice.
Wow. And it's you've served it over rice here.
Just
plain white rice?
We just serve it over a bed of white rice and you're good to go.
Are there a lot of hot spices in Brazilian cooking?
Yes, there is. On certain regions of Brazil, especially if you go to the northern region, states called Bahia, Recife, they tend to use an oil. It's called azeite, which means it would be a type of olive oil. Azeite de dendê. Very hot.
And what makes it hot?
It's extracted from in English translated, it would be palm oil.
But palm oil is not hot. Spicy.
Yeah. Well, the palm oil, I'm trying to translate the best way possible, but it's called azeite de dendê, and it's very spicy, and they use that a lot in the Brazilian culinary.
So now this is not spicy at all. It's just a very nice, mild flavors.
You can make it spicy. You can add your red peppers to it, jalapenos.
Now here's another dish that I like really a lot. It's got so many layers of flavor in it. It's a chicken dish. So tell us about that.
Oh, the chicken salad that I bought in today? It's called chicken salpicón. It's a chicken salad, and it just has a variety of little things in there, apples and peas and corn and carrots and chicken breasts, and you top it off with the little potato sticks.
Well, and it's got raisins in it?
Yes, you have raisins.
And olives.
Olives, yes.
I mean, there's no grapes?
No.
Oh, okay. Maybe it was the raisin then. I tasted it.
Yes, it was the raisins, probably.
So then what is the white sauce on it that you've mixed with it?
The white sauce is, particular salad, I use a can of table cream and a little bit of mayo.
A can of table cream?
Yes, a can of table cream.
I don't know what it
is. What is a
can?
Table cream. Like evaporated milk?
Kind of.
Okay.
It's in the same section as the evaporated milk and the condensed milk.
Okay.
And it's called canned
it's
cream.
It's called table cream.
Now, is that a specialty market or is that
No, you can find it in Walmart. You can find it in Publix.
Okay. I didn't know about that. Something to learn about.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure that's not very rich. but what I like is the layer of flavors. And then it's just covered with these little potato sticks.
Yes, yes.
Now, you told me that you can make that a day ahead.
Yes. We eat that a lot. Because on the weekends, especially in Rio, we tend to do a lot of barbecues. We're very big on meat, very big on barbecues. So we make that the day before, and we serve that with the barbecue, with the meats.
So it's a side dish.
Yes, more meat.
So now, let's say we're going to be watching the World Cup, having friends over, and maybe we want to make Brazilian food. Give us some tips on a simple, easy Brazilian party.
Okay. Well, the first thing off, you have to have the caipirinha.
I was going to ask you about that, but I was going to wait till Fred came in to ask you about that.
Tell us what it is.
I'm sure Fred knows what I'm talking about, right, Fred?
Oh, yes. Very tasty.
That is a traditional, the most traditional drink in Brazil. It's made out of sugar, lemons, lemon juice, and cachaça, which is our version of tequila.
Fred,
so you can have an idea.
Weigh in on this?
Well, all I can say is I've had them and I like them.
And you're here to tell the tale.
I am.
Okay, so after we've had that, does that mean we're not eating anything else?
No, what else are we going to have? We have a appetizer, cod fritters, made out of cod
bacalao.
Bacalao. Yeah. We have pão de queijo, which are little cheese breads, round cheese breads. We have frango a passarinho, which is chicken all seasoned up, and you just deep fry it.
Wow. Mm. So if we're going to have a party, we just make all of these and put them out.
Yeah, little appetizers. Now, in Brazil, we're very big on appetizers as well. We do not drink on an empty stomach. If you drink, you have to have something to nibble on, something to eat, something. You have to have something to eat.
So there are several different types of appetizers,
yes.
And it's in your
yes.
book. And can many of them be made in advance?
Yes, yes. The chicken, the deep fried chicken that I told you about, you can season that the day before, and then when everybody's over and while they're having their caipirinhas, you can just deep fry that
and what get do you that season that with?
Salt, pepper, a little bit of vinegar, a little bit of lemon juice, garlic. Heavy on the garlic and heavy on the scallions. The green scallions you want to sprinkle on top once it's already in the dish on the table to serve. You just sprinkle it on top.
Great. Mm-hmm. Now, people going down to Brazil, if they're going down for the tournament, you told me something that surprised me. What's going on in Rio?
Oh, all the neighborhoods. There's actually a contest going on in Rio of the most decorated street in the neighborhood. So the journalists in Rio are going to several different neighborhoods, several different barrios, and there are people, the neighbors from each neighborhood are just decorating the streets with all in yellow and green and flags and the trophy. And
oh, so a big party in
big,
Rio.
Big party.
Well, I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking about Brazilian cuisine and Brazilian parties with Anna French. We'll take a short break and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer and we're talking with Anna French. She's the author of A Pinch, A Dash, and A Pocketful of Cash, Simple Recipes for the Budget-Conscious Cook. And these are simple Brazilian recipes. And she's been giving us some tips about Brazilian dishes and how to create a Brazilian-style party for the World Cup tournament at home. And on another note, please come and see me this Sunday, June 8th at 2 p.m. I'm going to be giving a smoothie demonstration. That's a smoothie drink. Bonnie's looking at me. What?
No.
It's going to be at the FIU Jewish Museum of Florida. It's from my latest book, Simply Smoothies. It's for the American Diabetes Association. So how about a peanut butter banana smoothie? Come and taste it. Bonnie?
I think Elvis Presley would love that.
Exactly. I was just thinking that.
I was just going to say, I was going to call it an Elvis Presley smoothie, but I thought peanut butter banana sounded good,
now,
too.
Now, why didn't you bring any of these in for us to taste?
Well, we're having Brazilian today.
Okay.
All right.
I think peanut butter and banana smoothie would go great with...
With the Brazilian food? Okay. The
Do
museum?
Do you have any with a little rum in them?
That would be good, right? Yeah. The museum is located at 301 Washington Avenue on South Beach. And for more information, go to jewishmuseum.com. That's this Sunday at 2 p.m. Come on over and have a taste. And now it's dinner in minutes time. So, dinner in minutes today. It's summer. It's a quick and easy summer dish. It's sausage potato salad. Now, you can serve this either warm or at room temperature. And it's even better made a day ahead because then the potatoes absorb the sauce. So, what you do is you just cut some potatoes into about half-inch pieces and don't even peel them, just wash them. I put them in cold water. Put a cover on it and bring it to the boil for 15 minutes. That's all. Meanwhile, I take a turkey sausage, but if Joe were here, he'd have me do a pork sausage.
Regular
absolutely.
Sausage.
I was going to say.
Yes. So for Joe, we'd make a pork sausage, cut them into slices and saute them, and then you just make a dressing of some vinegar and mustard and some oil. And add a little chopped onion to it. And if you didn't want to make your own dressing, then just buy your favorite vinegar and oil dressing. Add some chopped onion. Mix that into the warm potatoes so they can absorb the sauce with the sausages. Serve it with some sliced tomatoes, a warm baguette. So simple. And the complete recipe and a photo, it's at dinnerinminutes.com. And also, if you'd like another recipe, try my wasabi crusted salmon salad. That's in today's Miami Herald. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred, what are we drinking?
Well, we're drinking Brazilian wine. And with the equator cutting all the way across Brazil, you might think it's too hot there to make wine. But you'd be wrong. Brazil is a big country, and it has a wine region in the Serra Gaúcha mountain range that's 1,800 miles south of the equator. and it's 2,000 feet up in the mountains, so it's plenty cool for grapes. In fact, the first wines in either of the Americas started there in 1532, which is centuries earlier than the United States, when a Portuguese grower came to plant vines in his country's colony, and the vines failed, but at least it was a start. And from then on, winemaking in Brazil was kind of up and down, going up when Jesuit priests made sacramental wines in the 1600s, going down in the 1700s as Portugal banned it for competing with its own wines. And then there's been a wave of modernization since 1990, in which the wines are getting a lot better. And today, Brazil specializes in lively, sparkling wines, plus Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, Merlot, that sort of thing. Unfortunately, they're kind of hard to find in Florida.
I was going to ask you about that. Would it say Brazilian wines on it?
It would, and I called 7 big Brazilian restaurants in South Florida and did not locate a single bottle. They tend to serve Chilean and Argentinian wines. So, although, now, I have to say this may be changing with Brazil's FIFA World Cup hoopla. The country is making a big push to sell its wines here. And the distributor called Vinícola Perini has Brazilian Macau brand Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, and some other wines at Global Liquors in Miami and Bistro Mezzaluna in Fort Lauderdale and some other locations. Also, if you really want to get out and try some Brazilian wines, in Palm Beach, Café Beaulieu in the Brazilian Court Hotel is bringing in some Brazilian wines and holding a $75 Brazilian wine dinner on June 26, featuring Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, and Merlot. And you can sign up for that by calling 561-655-6060. Now, I tasted some Brazilian wines at a Brazilian restaurant in Miami years ago, and I found that the sparkling wines, that's kind of their specialty these days, and they're nice and soft and rich and dry, and the reds are big and hearty. Just the thing, as I was saying, to go with those chunks of beef, lamb, and pork that Brazilian restaurant waiters keep bringing to your table and bringing to your table while you try to eat them up and you can never catch up. So you really do need some pretty sturdy wine to go with that.
Okay, sounds good. Sounds very delicious. Thank you, Fred. We have a phone call here on line one. It's Jacques in Miami Beach. Hi, Jacques. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you? It's me again.
Yes.
I am French, but I'm Brazilian also. And I think before we end the show, we have to talk about our national dish. It is called feijoada.
Feijoada, yes. Yes, of course. Anna?
Yes. And feijoada, feijão, as beans. And it's made of black beans. Originally, it's the dish we serve to slaves.
Well, and Anna was, Jacques, Anna was telling me about this dish. Anna, you have a feijoada in your book, but
yes.
You say it's French style. It's your style.
Yes, I kind of tweaked it a little bit my way. And I do give both options of doing it my way or the traditional way. But yes, it is a food that originated from the slaves.
And Jacques was trying to tell us that what you were telling me, Anna, is that originally it was the slaves because they ate the parts of the pig that their masters wouldn't eat.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Which are now considered the gourmet parts of the pig.
Yes.
Exactly. And the way to do it in the Brazilian way, because the French do something called cassoulet, which is you get your black beans, you cook them halfway, and then you start adding pork parts like...
That is correct.
Yes, feet and ears and nose and tail, and everything is salted, and after the beans are cooked, then it's ready, and you will serve it with orange slices and what you call in America,
yes,
collard greens.
Okay, Jacques, well, thank you so much for your call. Talking about the orange slices, Anna, you were telling me there's a reason for the orange slices?
Yes, because the feijoada itself is it's a very heavy meal and very fattening. So the orange helps cut back a little bit on the
grease. Some of that fat.
Yes.
It must take all day to make that dish.
Yes, it's time consuming, but it is so worth it at the end.
Okay. Well, talk about delicious. We haven't gotten to Brazilian desserts.
Of course, Linda. Nothing would be complete without dessert.
Dessert. So tell me your favorite one, Anna.
My favorite one, my favorite one in particular is what we call here in Miami flan, but in Portuguese we call it pudim de leite, which would translating
into
would
flan.
Be,
right.
Yeah, it would be
something of milk.
A milk pudding.
Yeah.
And that's made out of condensed milk and eggs, and you just put it in the oven in a water bath for about an hour.
Right, and then, but you also mentioned that there was a chocolate dessert.
Yes, it's called.
let's get to the basic problem here.
Yes, it's called brigadeiro, and basically what they are is chocolate truffles, and they are very successful in Brazil at weddings, at baby showers, at children's parties, everything.
Well, now, how do they differ from a regular chocolate truffles? Are they similar to what we find in the stores here?
They're very simple to make. They're actually just made out of condensed milk, a little bit of butter, and some Nesquik, believe it or not.
Oh, so it's not Nesquik? Even real cocoa.
No.
But they turn into this chocolatey, delicious, scrumptious, and then you let it cool off, and you just make little balls of them, you know, little.
She's making them as she's talking. She's rolling
hands together.
And then
you just covered them with chocolate sprinkles.
So, that's a very interesting, simple and easy to do. Now, also you were mentioning that to me that if you're going down to Brazil, the hotels are already full.
Yes, pretty much the hotels in Rio are pretty much already booked out. I think they are up to 90% already.
Mm. Wow. Very interesting. Well, it's been really fascinating. We'll look forward to World Cup next week.
Yes, thanks, Anna.
It's been a very tasty week, Anna French. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on the show, Linda.
Well, no, thank you for all this wonderful food.
Thank you.
Her book is A Pinch, A Dash, and A Pocket Full of Cash, Simple Recipes for the Budget-Conscious Cook. Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Bonnie Berman.
Thank you, and thank you, Fred. Great
to be with you. And next week, it's going to be all about fried chicken. We'll be talking about with Lee Schrager. He has a book called Fried and True. So I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And we thank you for joining us today. We appreciate your spending your time with us. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction and production assistance from our online producer, Paul Leary. Of course, we have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and more information, links, photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Please join Ed Bell tomorrow at this time for another edition of South Florida Arts Beat. And we return Monday with a rebroadcast with noted author and journalist Andrew Solomon. His latest book is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. Bonnie Berman sending my best, and joining you in sending your best, I'm sure, for Joseph Cooper's quick recovery and return. Have a great day and weekend, and please stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.